The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsugsinsurance.com. That is gsugginsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 4, 2023. Outlined in a red border, as usual, the front page offers a secondary narrow inner white border. Powered by Time CO2 is part of the caption, the rest being Time 100 Climate, the 100 most influential leaders driving business to real climate action. Those letters are all in bright blue, including Time in large capital lettering, and it appears that the background is supposed to be a snow scene. It's white or off-white with a very pale, icy blue sky at the top third. There are the giant windmills, there are people on scooters, there are automobiles and trucks, there are people superimposed sitting upon the 100s, people walking as if hiking a mountain. These are not photographic depictions, but rather illustrations. With all the coloration then, it looks like a red, teal blue, and white cover. With our 100th year in the top right-hand corner, as if a page-turning thumbprint. Beginning with a photo of one of the photos of the year, and this edition does include Time's 100 most influential leaders, some of which will be read, others which will not be read. One of the photos of the year is about half a page or more in color, but the colors are almost sepia-toned in pale and dull beige and lots of browns. There is one automobile in the picture. It's red. In the background is a dusky blue sky, as if it might be nearing sunset, white clouds with gray underbellies, trees bordering what appears to be a bridge or a highway, because I see barricades down the center as well as railings off to each side. But in the foreground appear three men. They're all dressed similarly. They have tan to khaki trousers on, white shirts. A couple of them are wearing dark colored, either dark brown or black sweaters over those shirts. All three wear what appear to be, in the texture of the photo, which of course is flat, brown leather vests. All three wear short-brimmed, but brimmed all around, caps. They're dark-colored, either black or dark brown, with some kind of braiding around where the hat band would be. They look middle-aged to a bit older, in fact, to have facial hair, and they're leading a very, very large flock of sheep. The sheep block all lanes of this bridge or highway. The sheep are oncoming, so I'm not going to try to count, but I think there are hundreds of sheep looking at me from this photograph. The caption reads, "Shepherds block the road to a political rally in Poland before national elections in October." It looks like a pastoral scene, but I wouldn't want to be on either end of this bridge or section of highway waiting to go somewhere. Beginning then with the brief news world. This, it looks like a question and answer situation in the column. There is one photo here. It's small, and it, too, is a dusty brown color. A very high fence predominates the center of this photograph, not quite going straight down the middle, but it goes straight down the middle and then turns to the right at a 90-degree angle. There are people, apparently soldiers, amassed at either side of this fence. They're not in the foreground. They're rather small, almost specks, but they're dressed in dark attire, and the dark attire does stand out from the desert, the browns, the tawny tans and gray background. I see only a few items of vegetation, and it looks very sagebrushy to me. The caption reads, Israeli troops along the border with Gaza, November 13, amid war with Hamas. Israel's former PM, a two-state solution is the only solution. This is by Eric Cortaleza. With a war raging between Israel and Hamas, it is hard to imagine a new dawn of peace. The violence threatens to paralyze the moral and political imaginations of Israelis and Palestinians alike, deepening the impression that accommodation will remain forever out of reach. But to hear one of Israel's elder statesmen tell it, now is precisely the moment to resurrect the goal of a peace process. The right way to look to the two-station solution, not because of justice to the Palestinians, which is not the uppermost on my priorities, but because we have a compelling imperative to disengage from the Palestinians to protect our own security, our own future, our own identity, former Israeli minister Ehud Barak tells Time. Barak, who led the country from 1999 to 2001 and is one of its most decorated military figures, came closer than any other Israeli leader to securing a peace deal with the Palestinians. In a wide-ranging interview conducted over Zoom, October 27, he discussed the possible end games for Gaza after the war, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's political future, and how the October 7 massacre has transformed the Israeli psyche. The following has been edited and condensed. Question: what was your first reaction when you learned of the attack? Answer: it was immediately clear it's the most severe blow we suffered since the establishment of the State of Israel. Israel was established to create one place on earth where Jews can live and go to sleep in their own quiet. For my generation, our formative experience in life was the 1973 war. For people who are about the age I was in 1973 and even younger, this will be the formative experience of their life. It will define what they think about Israel and the Zionist project. Question: why was Israel so unprepared? Answer: it was a major failure of our intelligence. It will be clarified only when there is a full investigation. Question: how much responsibility does Netanyahu bear? Answer: Netanyahu used to say, anyone who's against a two-state solution should support his attitude toward Hamas, which was basically to let them be alive and kicking. He basically backed them by allowing the Qataris to send some $1.5 billion over 5 years into the Gaza Strip. About half of it was used by Hamas to build its military capabilities. It is this element that disturbs the Israeli people. Everyone remembers that he strengthened Hamas. Question: can Netanyahu survive this? Answer: he lost the trust of the people. In normal countries, he would have resigned on his own immediately. But it is not unprecedented that when a government in Israel refuses to resign, the public will impose it upon them. Question: can Israel conduct this military operation without causing so many civilian casualties? Answer: we cannot and will not pretend to be able to do it without any collateral damage and civilians being killed. We are committed to make all possible efforts to minimize it. We warn in advance. We want some 1.1 million people to leave the northern Gaza Strip. Hamas is threatening them and telling the civilians to stay. It is a tragedy, but we cannot give Hamas impunity because they're using their coercive power over the citizens. Question. Do you think two states as a goal can be revived after this massacre? Answer. I think there is a need in Israel under the heaviest, most difficult conditions never to lose sight of the objective. The right way is to look to the two-state solution, not because of justice to the Palestinians, which is not the uppermost on my priorities, but because we have a compelling imperative to disengage from the Palestinians, to protect our own security, our own future, our own identity. If there's only one political entity reigning over the area between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, it will inevitably become either non-Jewish or non-democratic. If this bloc of millions of Palestinians can vote, Israel will become overnight a binational state with a Muslim majority. First, we have to focus on the war, but the vision and the readiness to act upon it, once the time is right, should always be there. The brief milestones comprises this page, and there is one photo here. It's of a young man in a blue suit with kind of a purplish shirt and tie. He has lots of curly dark hair. He is almost smirking, but not at the camera, because he is surrounded by other men dressed in dark blue suits. There is a tree in the background, and it is Sam Bankman-Fried, convicted, disgraced, crypto mogul, written by Andrew R. Chow. It took 1 year for Sam Bankman-Fried to transform from beloved billionaire entrepreneur to convicted felon. November 2, a New York jury found Bankman-Fried guilty on all seven counts he was charged with by the Department of Justice, including defrauding customers and investors of his cryptocurrency exchange, FTX. Bankman-Fried, the jurors decided, was part of a conspiracy to extract more than $8 billion from FTX customers, funnel it to his trading firm, Alameda Research, then spend it on a penthouse in the Bahamas, investments in AI companies, and political donations. In October 2021, Forbes anointed Bankman-Fried the richest 20-something in the world, but last November, fears mounted on social media that Bankman-Fried's empire had a lot less money than it let on. When panicked customers withdrew billions of dollars in deposits from FTX, it turned out Bankman-Fried did not have the funds to pay them back. FTX declared bankruptcy less than 2 weeks later. Bankman-Fried pleaded not guilty and testified FTX's collapse was the result of mistakes, not fraud. But the jury was not convinced. It took them less than 5 hours to find him guilty on all counts. Bankman-Fried will be sentenced in March and potentially faces over 100 years in prison. Bankman-Fried's defense was severely hampered by the testimony of three members of his inner circle, who alleged under oath he repeatedly directed them to commit fraud in order to borrow billions from customers. FTX executive Nishad Singh called the acts heinously criminal. Caroline Ellison, Bankman-Fried's ex-girlfriend and CEO of Alameda, presented evidence showing she'd warned Bankman-Fried for months about Alameda's severe debt to FTX. When she recounted watching FTX collapse 1 year prior, she burst into tears. I felt a sense of relief that I did not have to lie anymore. Protected abortion rights in Ohio vote. This is written by Sonia Mansour. It's a short column. Ohio voters, November 7, approved a constitutional amendment guaranteeing an individual right to abortion and other kinds of reproductive health care, a major win for abortion rights in one of the year's most closely watched votes. The amendment known as Issue 1 put Ohio at the center of the nation's abortion battle. The practical effect is to undo a law passed by the Republican legislature that would have banned abortions after about 6 weeks. Beyond Ohio, Democrats may look to the use of the citizen ballot initiative as a reliable tactic to protect abortion rights. Says Mary Ruth Ziegler, law professor at UC Davis, what it suggests is that voters in a lot of conservative states are not as far to the right on abortion as their state lawmakers. Finally, a small column, or rather a horizontal column, beneath these two articles, discovered the oldest black hole scientists have ever located, November 6, clocking in at 13.2 billion years of age, and confirming theories that supermassive black holes have existed since the Big Bang. Ended the nearly four-month Hollywood actors' strike when SAG-AFTRA and the studios reached a deal over a new three-year contract November 8, including limits on AI and bonuses for streaming hits. Filed, office-sharing venture WeWork for bankruptcy protections November 6. With analysts citing its overly rapid expansion as a factor. The company had once been valued at $50 billion. Now here's a little thumbnail, almost, photograph in color of an elegantly dressed lady. We see just her upper hat, the upper half of her torso and her head, but she's wearing purple with a gold flower pin on the right, on the left side, at her shoulder. She's blonde. She's smiling slightly and is wearing gold earrings. Her hair is in an updo, a bouffant. Died Marianne Trump Berry, a former federal judge and sister to President Donald Trump, November 13 at 86. She resigned in 2019 amid a judicial conduct investigation about whether she committed tax fraud. The brief news, volcanic cracks, is the caption for this half-page photo in color. It's a highway. It's an asphalt highway with all kinds of lights and pedestrian crossing markings, and there's a pedestrian jaywalking across the highway. The land looks flat, but it does have a brownish-green tinge to the lawns. Perhaps this is a park. There are buildings behind it, one-story and two- and three-story buildings. The sky is blue. The main road in the Icelandic seaside town of Grindavik lies cracked open November 13, as thousands of earthquakes shook the country's southwest because of magma shifting under the Earth's crust. Officials had evacuated the town's roughly 4,000 residents November 11, after experts warned the seismic activity suggested nearby Mount Fagradalsfjall volcano could erupt. I don't see any volcano on the landscape. It must be tucked away on either side of the camera's lens. The bulletin, How War in the Middle East Got the British Home Secretary Fired. This is written by Anna Gordon. Suella Braverman, the controversial Home Secretary in Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's cabinet, was fired after making divisive comments about pro-Palestinian protesters. She will be replaced by James Cleverly, who had been Foreign Secretary, and former Prime Minister David Cameron will replace him. The November 13 announcement came after Braverman wrote an article in the Times of London in which she claimed police were playing favorites and not enforcing the law when it came to pro-Palestinian protests and referred to protesters as hate marchers. Braverman wrote on X November 14 that Sunak had not honored policy agreements they had made when she took the position and said the protests were a breaking point. I have become hoarse urging you to consider legislation to ban the hate marches and help stem the rising tide of racism, intimidation, and terrorist glorification threatening community cohesion. The war between Israel and Hamas has led to mass protests throughout London, with hundreds of thousands calling for a ceasefire. November 11, far-right groups, including the English Defense League, confronted pro-Palestinian protesters in London. 9 officers were injured, and 145 people were arrested. This is not the first time Braverman's impolitic speech has gotten her in trouble. She's referred to the UK's migrant crisis as an invasion and homelessness as a life choice. She was forced to resign from her position as Home Secretary once before in October 2022 when she was discovered to have shared confidential documents with a Member of Parliament. She was reinstated a week later. There is a photo here. It's about 3/4 tall, of a woman, which may be Suella Braverman, but there's no caption. This woman is dressed in a red suit with a purple shirt. She has very long, longer than shoulder-length hair, and dark eyes, and she's looking right at the camera. Now, here's one of the entries in the Time 100 Leadership series about climate. It is Rebel with a Cause, Tadashi Yanai, that's Y-A-N-A-I, grew Uniqlo, U-N-I-Q-L-O, into a global force. Now he is out to fix his country, by Charlie Campbell, Tokyo. There's a full-page photo opposite this the beginning of the article of Yanai at Uniqlo's Ariake headquarters September 15. This looks like a gentleman who is middle-aged. He has a thinning hairline with dark hair, dark eyes. He has wire-rimmed glasses. No smile, no frown, just a really serious facial expression looking directly at the camera. Arms crossed across his chest. He's wearing a dark sweater, I'm going to say brown, over dark pants, maybe black, maybe very dark brown, a blue and white pinstriped shirt with a collar, and it's open at the top button. I see a watch on his left wrist as it crosses his chest. I don't know what kind, but it has a luminous dial. Again, this is Tadashi Yanai. The previous evening, storm clouds have cleared to bathe Tokyo in crisp sunshine. Tadashi Yanai, Japan's richest man and the founder of $73 billion apparel empire, Uniqlo, is perusing the art books that line his wood-paneled office, which, like most of his firm's cavernous headquarters, commands sweeping vistas of the Sumida River. Finally, he retrieves one he believes will be of particular interest, a tome of historical photographs curated by Time that features John F. Kennedy on the cover in deep conversation with his brother Bobby during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I particularly like his saying, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," says Yanai, 74, carefully replacing the book in its stand. That's what I want to talk about today. On the face of it, Yanai has many reasons to feel upbeat. Fast Retailing, the holding company that operates Uniqlo and 8 other brands he established out of his father's tailoring business, saw operating profits of $2.54 billion for the year to August 31, up 28.2% year over year. The firm's share price, meanwhile, has soared 31% so far this year, propelling Yanai's personal wealth to $36 billion. He also has bold plans to finally conquer the U.S. by nearly tripling Uniqlo's existing 72 North American outlets by 2027. The rosy outlook radiates across Japan, where a perennially sluggish economy is now predicted to grow faster than those of the U.S. and Europe, its bourse riding a three-decade high. Moreover, in response to the Ukraine war, Japan has pushed through a transformative increase in defense spending, and in May welcomed world leaders for a G7 summit in Hiroshima, galvanizing a resurgent leadership role for the world's number three economy. The alliance between Japan and the United States is unprecedentedly strong and deep, Prime Minister Fumio Kishida told Time in late April. Yet, Yanai is not buying his nation's new swagger. Instead, it is time for some home truths, he says, insisting he wants to deliver a shocking statement to his compatriots. Wake up, he says squarely. Japan is not an advanced nation at all, because we've been in a dormant state for 30 years. Yanai's sobering pitch is that Japan's economy is teetering on a precipice because of an unhealthy obsession with manufacturing, workers conditioned to corporate bloat, and a budget financed by soaring debt rather than tax receipts. In December, Japan's cabinet approved a record $858 billion general account budget for 2023, despite expecting only $493 billion in tax revenue, with plans to issue $250 billion in new government bonds over the same period. Japan's public debt is already 264% of GDP, the highest in the world, and nominal wages, not adjusted for inflation, rose by just 4% from 1990 to 2019, compared with 145% in the U.S. productivity. Productivity languishes at the bottom of G7 nations. In Beijing and Shanghai, people are getting two and three times the compensation of equivalent positions in Japan, says Yanai. We need to normalize Japan's economy. I'm turning again to this full-page photo of Mr. Yanai, and I think I forgot to mention that the backdrop is in brilliant orange, degrading to golden yellow, lime yellow, and finally a bluish pink. Returning to the text now, Yanai is putting his money where his mouth is, and in March hiked the wages of Fast Retailing's 8,400 or so employees in Japan by up to 40%. That still is low. It should be much higher, he confesses. He's calling on Japan's government to take similarly proactive measures, such as raising interest rates, cutting handouts, and making sweeping regulatory changes to prevent the nation of 125 million from sleepwalking into disaster. Fiscal lethargy is never a good look for a key U.S. ally, but especially not for one in the direct shadow of China, which Washington has come to regard not only as an economic competitor, but also as a global rival. Still, Yanai's rallying cry chafes with Japanese executives who owe their careers to steadily climbing the corporate ladder. Whether they will buy into his subversive fervor is a huge question. Yanai is not coy about the stakes. Unless we tap into the rest of the world and become more active, there will be no future for the Japanese people. Yanai cannot help but swim against the tide. He is a vibrant dynamo in a corporate culture famed for gray conformity and happily flaunts his success despite local taboos against ostentatious wealth. He owns two golf courses on Maui alone. Yanai has zero hesitation skewering the political elite when rival CEOs are more concerned by their stock price. The Japanese government and bureaucrats need to have their mindsets challenged, he says, because they know nothing. But a man whose 2003 autobiography is titled One Win and Nine Losses cannot be accused of arrogance. His bootstraps ascension story has been one of struggles overcome, mistakes owned, self-doubt always lingering. Hailing from the town of Ube in Yamaguchi Prefecture, Yanai grew up in the cramped rooms above his parents' shop, which sold off-the-rack suits. He studied political economy at Tokyo's prestigious Waseda University, but graduated without going to any classes, he says, because of a leftist student walkout that lasted 18 months. But the break in studies gave him the opportunity to travel to the U.S. and U.K., where the proliferation of mid-market clothing shops planted a seed that he would eventually sprout back home. After a brief stint selling men's clothes for a supermarket chain, Yanai was handed the keys to his father's shop in 1972. But within 2 years, all the staff bar one had walked out because of frictions over his management style. The only colleague to remain still works with him. Still, the business grew steadily until in 1984, Yanai established the first branch of the unique clothing warehouse, later shortened to Uniqlo, in central Hiroshima. Uniqlo's early success was rooted in a low price point combined with high-quality materials. Yanai doggedly experimented with new fabrics, like the popular Heat Tech range that retains warmth in winter while breathing in sweltering summers. The firm's breakthrough came in 1998 when Yanai opened its first Tokyo outlet. Its debut campaign was a lightweight fleece for just $15, which caused a sensation amid the cost-conscious post-bubble economy. Every fourth Japanese consumer bought one. Yanai transformed his family's tiny clothing store into an international phenomenon, with more than 3,500 fast retailing stores across the world, including Uniqlo flagships in London's Covent Garden, Milan's Piazza Corduzio, and Fifth Avenue in New York City. Uniqlo has already overtaken Gap in terms of global reach and is fast hunting down Sweden's H&M and Spain's Zara. My goal is to drive growth wherever possible, insists Yanai. Still, there have been blunders. In 2001, Uniqlo opened 21 stores in the UK, only to shut 16 of them within 2 years because of miserable results. In 2005, Uniqlo opened its first three U.S. stores in New Jersey, but all were closed by the following year. We were nobody, Yanai says. The U.S. was my biggest failure. Yet he kept striving and evolving, whereas his first billions were owed to plain, functional, durable clothing at minimal cost. Today, Uniqlo has moved up the value chain. It has design collaborations with the MoMA, Louvre, and Tate Modern, as well as brand ambassadors, including tennis superstar Roger Federer, who in 2018 signed a $30 million per year deal that tripled that of his previous sponsor, Nike. For Yanai, the underlying philosophy is to fail rather than fade. He bears the scars from Ube, which was a coal mining boomtown until the energy transition caused the pits to close and jobs to move elsewhere. As they did, all the shops that served them also shuttered. It was a grim lesson that every business plan has a shelf life, and those that do not adapt perish. Yanai's passion for pushing boundaries is embodied by Uniqlo's Tokyo headquarters, which sprawls over the size of a city block, with 14-foot-high ceilings, cafes, and hangout spaces. The R&D lab boasts test chambers where new materials are plunged into minus 40-degree centigrade chills or torrential downpours as the wearer's comfort is monitored via thermal imaging cameras. In the basement are seven dedicated photo and video studios where models parade next season's lines, and the color-corrected images are uploaded immediately to the firm's website by technicians perched 10 feet away. There is a library overflowing with design books and a great hall modeled on a sumo stadium whose polished timber bleachers can seat 1,000 for large presentations. Everything is geared toward collaboration and control. Instead of simply entrusting overseas suppliers to replicate sample garments, Uniqlo maintains at great expense an innovation factory in Tokyo, where it first finesses the entire manufacturing process. Ranks of 3D sewing machines that can stitch complex garments from just one thread without seams, making them up to 40% more efficient, clatter away as production managers tinker with hundreds of variables to optimize quality and speed, down to the length and temperature of the post-manufacturing wash. Then the entire production manifest is sent to partner factories in Bangladesh or Vietnam that are equipped with identical machines and materials, ensuring precise replication, even when production is ramped up by a factor of thousands. It is critical that quality goes together with fashion and functionality, says Yanai. Uniqlo's agility and swelling global prominence run counter to the diminishing imprint of many storied Japanese firms. Up until the 2000s, Japan teamed with engineering pioneers. Casio invented the pocket calculator, Seiko the quartz wristwatch, Fujifilm the first digital camera. But in recent years, complacency, conservative leadership, and fierce competition have seen Japanese brands fall behind. Japanese businesses are managed as if they're looking in the rearview mirror, says Yanai. Japanese people need to come to terms with the reality that Japan is lagging behind other Asian countries. Many in Japan agree. Last year, Kishida unveiled plans to boost the number of startups in Japan tenfold by 2027 by helping entrepreneurs secure state or private funding. Just 0.08% of Japan GDP is invested in startups, compared with 0.64% in the U.S. and 2.61% in Israel. A key barrier is psychological. Japan's business culture is rooted in the concept of neimawashi, or consensus building, an informal process of quietly gathering support and feedback for any proposed project or directional shift. By contrast, Yanai's leadership style is that of a dictator, says Yasushi Hasegawa, managing director of Tokyo-based business consultancy Fenetra Partners. The biggest shortcoming of Japan is that there is no individuality, says Yanai. People need to stand on their own feet. Many in Japan wonder whether whoever succeeds Yanai will maintain the risk-taking ethos so pivotal to Uniqlo's success. In 2002, Yanai handed the reins of Uniqlo to Genichi Tamatsuka, a former deputy, but returned as the firm's president after 3 years, saying that Tamatsuka wanted steady growth, but I want more transformation and growth. In August, Yanai again announced he was taking a step back from day-to-day operations, with Daisuke Tsukagoshi, former Uniqlo Global CEO, becoming the brand's executive director, president, and COO. The burning question is whether the post-Yanai Uniqlo retains his zeal for disruption and pushing boundaries. Maybe Uniqlo will be a normal company after he dies, suggests Hasegawa. What Uniqlo can do for Japan, at least in its founder's eyes, is clear. In this next phase, then, Yanai may be left asking what his country can do to Uniqlo. from the Time Off section, the movie wives are speaking by Stephanie Zakarik. The wives of famous men, often relegated to the sidelines, meaning the wives, reclaim space in a crop of new films. The mid-20th century wife is such a vivid type in popular art that we think we've got her down cold. In our minds, she's usually a June Cleaver cliché. But in real life, the mid-century wife faced daunting expectations. She may have worked outside the home during wartime, but more often than not, the wife life changed all that. She was supposed to bear children and raise them to be cheerful, productive adults, all while keeping a spotless home and having dinner on the table by six. Stressed out from all of that, barbiturates, benzos, and booze were the dysfunctional solution. The mid-century wife could not win, though we all know of women who kicked free of those expectations, sometimes at great cost to themselves or those around them. These women usually don't get movies made about them, yet somehow, often miraculously, the culture subconsciously corrects some of its problems. Whether by accident or by unconscious design, 2023 has been the year of the movie wife. In Bradley Cooper's Maestro, Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, even Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer and Michael Mann's Ferrari, those last two made by male directors who are not exactly known for exploring the experiences of women, the movie wife has come barging in from the sidelines in all her glory. She may not be the main character, but she is resolute about taking up space in the frame. We have been told for decades now by the men who move money around in Hollywood that movies about women don't sell. The success of Barbie may have shifted that thinking, but we'll have to wait and see. Maybe that's why in films that are mostly about men, it is always gratifying to discover women who are adamantly and defiantly themselves. Think of Reese Witherspoon's feisty, yet fine-grained performance as June Carter Cash in James Mangold's Walk the Line, or ingenue Ellis Taylor's magnificent no-nonsense turn as Oracine Price, the mother of Venus and Serena Williams in Reynaldo Marcus Green's King Richard. All of these characters are adjacent to men. Otherwise, their stories might not be told at all. But adjacency is often the thing that, for better or worse, puts a woman in the spotlight, testing her in ways she could not have imagined. How a male filmmaker deals with that says a lot about him. It is better for men and women when a movie treats both as complicated beings, interconnected in that risky experiment known as marriage. In The Right Stuff, Philip Kaufman's 1983 film, adapted from Tom Wolfe's book about the early years of the U.S. space program, the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts, played by actors including Pamela Reed, Veronica Cartwright, Mary Jo Deschanel, and Kathy Baker, are treated as individuals with distinctive character traits, even though they are supporting players in the story. Kaufman seemed to be taking a stance against the idea of wives being lumped together as faceless helpmeets. Sometimes the things a filmmaker chooses not to focus on tell us the most about his motives. In Maestro, in theaters, November 22, and on Netflix, December 20, Cooper directs himself in the role of Leonard Bernstein, but he includes very few scenes of Bernstein conducting or writing. Cooper wants to tell us things we do not already know about Bernstein, as a lover to both men and women, as an affectionate father, as a whirlwind force. More than a survey of a man, Maestro is a portrait of a complex, ardent marriage, which makes Bernstein's wife, the Chilean-born actor Felicia Montalegre, played by Carey Mulligan, the key to the story. Mulligan captures Montalegre's ladylike essence, her elegant manners, her obvious pride in being married to a genius, a man she loved fiercely. She fell in love with Bernstein knowing that he was, depending on how you want to frame issues of the human heart and libido, either gay or bisexual. Later, his affairs tore at the fabric of their marriage, yet she had made a clear-eyed choice in the beginning, and Mulligan's performance, fiery and opulent at once, gives life to a complicated idea. Making the right choices in life does not necessarily protect us from pain. You cannot really know what you're signing up for in a marriage until you're well into it. In Maestro, Montalegre puts a human face on that idea. The idea of a woman quietly standing by her man through infidelity is so common in the movies that we tend to think of it as a plot device. But in reality, these experiences are as individual and distinct as the real-life people who get through them. In Oppenheimer, released this summer, Emily Blunt plays Kitty Oppenheimer, the wife of Cillian Murphy's genius physicist and ladies' man, J. Robert Oppenheimer. And in Ferrari, in theaters December 25, Penelope Cruz's Laura Ferrari suffers not so silently as her husband, race car mogul Enzo, Adam Driver, builds a semi-secret life with another woman, Shailene Woodley's Lena Lardy, and their child. Both Laura and Kitty have good reason to be miserable, and in some ways they reflect the reality that mid-century wives often stuck with crummy husbands for practical reasons. But marital loyalty can be complicated. That was as true in the 1940s and 1950s as it is today. Kitty Oppenheimer had lived a dramatic life before she even met Oppenheimer. She was on her third husband when the two met, and she had joined the Communist Party in the 1930s, an affiliation that would haunt her. She was also a scientist in her own right, a biologist and botanist. Her union with Oppenheimer was stormy. She drank a little too much, and perhaps worse, spoke her mind freely. Nolan's movie shows all the ways Kitty was unmanageable as a wife. Manageability, after all, was a desirable quality in mid-century wives. But in a late scene testifying during her husband's kangaroo court security hearing before the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, she defends her husband and herself with icy directness. This is where a wife's unmanageability comes in handy. A woman who won't be controlled or bullied is sometimes a man's best ally. You could say the same of Cruz's Laura, who at first appears to want to sabotage her wayward husband's life and business. But Cruz vests Laura with an intricate combination of qualities, a kind of practicality mingled with fealty for a man who admittedly has not done right by her. Ultimately, she commits an act of generosity that saves her husband's company, though you never see her as a pushover. By saving her husband, she's also flexing her power, defying any expectation of how she should react or behave. A man who needs saving is not as strong as he thinks. That is true also of Elvis Presley, a great artist but something of a mess as a man. Priscilla Presley's affectionate but clear-eyed 1985 memoir, Elvis and Me, was previously adapted into a 1988 TV movie that almost no one remembers. Stories in which the wife is the main character have always been a relative rarity, but Coppola shifts that current with Priscilla, now in theaters. Newcomer Kaylee Spaney is superb as the woman who fell hard for a king when she was still a schoolgirl. She was 14, he was 24. But who also knew when it was time to walk away from his twisted castle. The movie wraps us close in Priscilla's dream of love to the point that we are as shattered by its inevitable end as she is. As a performer, Elvis, played here by Jacob Elordi, was one of the great symbols of mid-century modernity, but his ideas of what a wife should be were restrictively old-fashioned, a tragedy for both parties. We are in step with Spaney's Priscilla every moment, as she makes the transition from teenage daydreamer to cautious girlfriend to defiant wife. When she walks out that door, it's Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You, playing on the soundtrack. In real life, Elvis reportedly sang that song to Priscilla on the courthouse steps, just after their divorce was finalized, and he'd always wanted to record it, but Parton reluctantly had to refuse him. Elvis's devious manager, Colonel Tom Parker, had demanded half the publishing rights. And so a song that's an open declaration of undying love is also wrapped up in the necessity of walking away, of saying no, of withholding something you wish in your heart you could give, something that's the best thing a wife can do. Time Off Television by Judy Berman. This is an essay. It may be abridged for time constraints. Reality TV stops being polite. The first player viewers meet in Squid Game, The Challenge, a new reality competition based on the South Korean Netflix thriller that became an international phenomena, is a relatable everywoman named Starla. Who's not in debt, she asks, by way of explaining why she's competing for the $4.56 million prize, 456 players times $10,000. What's that like, to be able to pay off your house? What's that like, to be able to pay off your car? She never finds out. Starla's eliminated in the first round of the first game. As this introduction suggests, The Challenge prides itself on being merciless, like the scripted series that inspired it, minus the violent death that awaits each of the original Squid Games, eliminated contestants, obviously. The competition pits a cast of hundreds against one another in a gauntlet of playground games. That Netflix was so quick to exploit creator Hwang Dong-hyuk's searing critique of economic inequality for what will inevitably be another hit, and so many fans signed up to play along, is the latest evidence that satire is dead. But The Challenge also speaks to a larger trend toward cruelty within its game. Reality competitions have not historically been here to make friends. Many of the biggest early reality franchises, Survivor, The Apprentice, Big Brother, rewarded bad behavior. Shows like The Swan and Joe Millionaire preyed on female contestants' self-hatred and gullibility. All that seemed to be changing, however, in the late 2010s, when a wave of kinder, gentler reality shows, from The Great British Bake Off to Terrace House to Netflix's rebooted Queer Eye, subtly pushed back against the jibing of our first reality show president. But in the years since he reluctantly left office, and particularly in recent months, with the debut of such cutthroat contests as E's House of Villains and Netflix's Surviving Paradise, mean reality TV has returned with a vengeance. For a genre built on narcissism in front of the camera and manipulation behind it, the heel turn was inevitable. You cannot say the contestants on The Challenge did not know what they were getting into. Just like their Squid Game counterparts, they are served meager meals, sleep in bleacher-like bunks in a massive room with prison yard vibes, and are forced with each new twist to turn on people they have come to care for. More than the games themselves, which can be tedious and random, it is these conflicts that drive the show. The presence of some players with real connections on the outside, including a lovable mother-son duo, heightens the drama. For the cast of Surviving Paradise, the game is not as transparent. Led to believe that they're in for a summer of luxury, they instead find themselves competing in a class-coded contest that pits insiders in a posh villa against outsiders who camp in the woods and subsist on rice and beans. Betrayed by the producers, the cast members must then betray one another for a cash prize. This bait-and-switch setup is increasingly common on Netflix. Snowflake Mountain pulled off a similar sleight of hand, promising young adults deemed snowflakes luxury and delivering a grueling course in wilderness survival. Too Hot to Handle, which has made 5 seasons since premiering in 2020, recruits participants for what is supposed to be a regular dating show, then surprises them with a high-stakes game of chastity. But perhaps the most obvious indication that reality competitions are back to their old nasty ways is the premiere this fall of House of Villains. As in the above shows, the game is less about athleticism or talent than it is about the soft skills of social engineering, intimidation, duplicity, forging alliances that must eventually be severed. In this case, however, the players are established reality stars with villainous reputations, like notorious survivor liar Johnny Fairplay and the mononymous apprentice alum Omarosa, who briefly followed Mr. Trump to the White House. The fireworks burn as bright as you might expect. If you're going to watch people debase themselves for cash, they might as well be the best scrappers in the business. That article by Judy Berman was slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.